From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Tomorrow is the California primary. We'll have a debate on campaign finance reform. There are two competing initiatives in California.
The House of Democracy, as it were, is burning down. To get out there with a garden hose, which is what I would argue the other proposal does, is there's certainly nothing wrong with it. I'm not going to go out and cut the garden hose, but we just need, we got a five-alarm fire here. We need to get out some heavy equipment and do something about it.
And the San Francisco Bay Area has one of the highest rates of breast cancer in the world. We'll talk about the fight against toxics in California.
The clock keeps getting closer and closer to midnight, and if we don't pull that minute hand back, we're speaking of our own destruction, of our own death.
All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Tomorrow are the California, Washington, and Nevada primaries. Today, we focus on California. And you know, if you're a regular listener to Democracy Now!, if it's Monday, it's money. Today, campaign finance reform is the issue. We're going to look at two ballot initiatives that aren't being voted on tomorrow, but they will be or might be voted on in the fall. I'm joined by my co-host Larry Bensky in California, in Pacifica Studios of KPFA in Berkeley. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you very much, Amy. And today, because political reform is so popular here in California, we're going to talk to people who have two different ballot measures that, as you say, may be voted on in November. They're initiatives that have conflicting measures in them, and we expect a lively discussion this morning between, first of all, Ruth Holton, Executive Director of California Common Cause. Their ballot measure, which has qualified for November, is called the California Political Reform Act. And we're also talking with Doug Phelps. He is with the California Public Interest Research Group, and more particularly, Californians Against Political Corruption. They're sponsoring an anti-corruption act, which has not yet gathered enough signatures for November, but may do so in time to be on the ballot. Ruth Holton, why don't we begin with you? Would you just describe the measure that has qualified for the ballot, the California Political Reform Act?
This measure, which is actually sponsored by the League of Women Voters, Common Cause, AARP, and United We Stand America, would limit campaign contributions, it would limit campaign spending, it would ban fundraising in non-election years, it would ban contributions from lobbyists, it would ban candidates from transferring their campaign contributions to other candidates. It would, in fact, reduce by 97% the amount of contributions that the top 10 PAC contributors gave in the 1994 election. It is the toughest campaign finance reform law that in the nation, if passed as we expect by the voters in 1996. It was put on the ballot by a monumental grassroots effort. We had 4,000 volunteers who collected over half of the necessary signatures. And we were officially certified for the ballot by the Secretary of State's office several weeks ago.
Doug Phelps, the Californians Against Political Corruption are also circulating a ballot measure for 1996 called the Anti-Corruption Act. What is its status right now?
We are on the streets gathering signatures, and we expect that we will be on the ballot in November.
Well, what does your measure do that the measure that we just heard about from the California Common Cause people, the California Political Reform Act, what does the Anti-Corruption Act do that the Reform Act doesn't do?
There are several ways in which the two proposals differ. The first is that our proposal sets a limit on the amount of money that someone running for office in California can raise from outside of the district that they represent. It limits that to no more than 25% of the total amount of money that they raise. Secondly, ours limits individual contributions to only $100 for people running for the Assembly or the Senate, and $200 for those running for statewide office, which are substantially lower than the limits in the other proposal. And the third thing is that in trying to deal with the problem of the self-funded candidate, the person who isn't affected by our attempts to limit contributions because they just finance their own campaign, the Steve Forbes type of candidate, we set mandatory limits on spending and challenged the Supreme Court to relook at their ruling of 20 years ago in which they outlawed the idea of setting mandatory spending limits. So those are the major differences. The other thing that we try to do is, in addition to bringing down the overall goal here is to level the playing field so that people who are running for office are equally influenced by their voters, regardless of how much money they have to give. And in addition to trying to kibosh the fat cat contributions, we also try to churn up more participation by smaller donors by setting up a provision that allows citizen contribution committees to be formed and to have more liberal spending limits than what exists for, or contribution limits, I should say, than what exists for other PACs if they limit their contributions that they can accept to $25 or less.
Why don't we take it step by step? I wanted to ask Ruth Holton of Common Cause, what do you think of CalPERG and the Californians Against Political Corruption's proposal to limit the amount of money that comes in from outside the district?
We know that certainly it is the voters are very attracted to that idea. It has been already tossed out by the courts in Oregon. And we frankly would be very surprised if the courts would allow that to go into effect. We do not believe it would, because the courts have said, already ruled very clearly, that you can limit campaign contributions because of the corrupting effect on elected officials. And then the question obviously that is raised is, how can a $25 contribution from outside a district be more corrupting than a $100 contribution from inside the district? It's obviously going to be challenged. It may or may not eventually go into effect. Our concern was we wanted a measure that would go into effect right away so that voters would have reform in 1997.
Doug Phelps, your response to that?
Well, I don't know quite whether Ruth was saying she would support this proposal or not. Our proposal is to limit contributions from outside the district that a candidate represents to no more than 25% of the total money that they raise. First of all, this has not been ruled unconstitutional. It hasn't been ruled on. It was the ruling in Oregon had to do with a law which set up an absolute limit, not no money coming from outside the district. But the second point that we would make is, on all these issues, the constitutionality, from the point of view of building the progressive movement, almost everything worthwhile in terms of social change in American history has originally been ruled unconstitutional by the courts. I mean, if we had been afraid to keep organizing and keep pushing for these changes, we'd still have slavery, women still wouldn't have the right to vote, we wouldn't have a 40-hour work week, we'd still have child labor. You name it, it's been ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court originally, and they've only changed their rulings when faced with popular pressure and popular organizing. That's why we have to keep coming back on these issues. If we feel that something is unconstitutional, that is, it is wrong, it is not a good idea, it denies people their rights, then we shouldn't be doing it. But if it's simply the court making a bad ruling, then we've got to challenge that.
The bad ruling you're talking about here is Buckley versus Vallejo in 1976, isn't it?
Well, actually, no. That relates to another provision that we have in ours. But the court has not ruled on this question of in-district limits. And, in fact, we're pushing it at every level, on the state level and the federal level. And in fact, Common Cause and other organizations are actually supporting an in-district limitation in the law being proposed in Congress right now. So I think this is something that's worthwhile to put forward. It's very unclear that the court would even rule against this initially. I mean, we don't know that. When we get to the mandatory spending limits is when we get to the Buckley problem.
I'm not sure that we don't get to it right here, Ruth Holton. Isn't that just a kind of a side attack on Buckley versus Vallejo that we're talking about here? And
exactly.
Wouldn't the Supreme Court have to reverse itself?
It is, in fact, Buckley versus Vallejo that says that the reason you're allowed to limit campaign contributions is because of the corrupting effect that those contributions have on elected officials. As I said before, how can you possibly argue that a $25 contribution from outside a legislator's district is more corrupting than a $100 contribution from inside the district? I think it is important to note that the Oregon court did throw it out. They required a 90% in-district contribution requirement. There really, frankly, is not much of a difference. Doug mentioned that, you know, all the important things that have happened in our history have at one time been ruled unconstitutional. You know, what we are arguing is if we're going to pursue a court strategy, then let's pursue a court strategy after real, if there are tough reforms already in place, so that Californians don't have to wait for the court to maybe at some indeterminate time change their minds. Certainly the court did not recently change its mind on term limits. As you might recall, there are somewhat over 21 states that have passed term limits for congressional offices, and the court said no, despite the clear public sentiment that term limits, that they wanted term limits. So we want reform now. We think the voters of California deserve reform now. And then once reform is in place, the best reform that we can get under the current parameters that the court allows, then that's the time to look and say, okay, can we go forward? The other concern that we have about going to the court right now is the composition of the court. I mean, clearly it is what we like to say an ACLU court that will be very firm when it comes to free speech. And the court may well look at Buckley, which said a $1,000 limit was okay for individuals, and they say, wait a minute, that was 1976. Surely, you know, with cost of living, we should maybe raise that limit. So Common Cause looked very closely at, you know, is a challenge even feasible, and decided we may end up with a worse solution.
Here's the current situation in California, and we shouldn't be arguing over these legal interpretations. We're not judges. That's not what the voters have to decide. What the voters have to decide, what they think is right and fair, and pass it. Today in California, over 90% of the money being raised by people who hold office today in California is coming from outside of their districts. Now, why is it that someone would have to go and raise 90% of the money from people and interests and corporations that are not even in the district that they're representing? Is because they're not seeking to represent their districts. They're seeking to represent special interest groups which are giving them that money. And what we say is, look, 90% of the money is coming from outside of the district. That's not right. We think the voters support us on that. We think that people, if anything, would rather see no money coming from outside the district. You run, you campaign by appealing to the people in your district for their votes, for their donations. Because of the constitutional concern, we say, okay, we'll allow up to 25% of the total money to come from outside of the district, but that's it. And corrupting, whether I don't see how anybody can say that the idea that 90% of the donations going to political candidates in California is coming from outside of the districts that they represent is not an extremely corrupting influence on our whole process. It's destroying our democratic process.
I think also, I mean, it's important to remember, particularly for the progressive community, you know, California is becoming many more Republican candidates. We now have a Republican majority in the Assembly. With an in-district contribution limit, that means that people who want to support environmental candidates, people that want to support pro-choice candidates all over the state, because obviously these legislators are voting on issues that affect everybody in the state, not just the people in their district, people who want to support those kinds of candidates are going to be very limited in how they can do that.
But they're already limited. They can't vote for everyone. Why should I be able to give money to everyone if I can't vote for everyone? If I can't vote for someone in another district, why should I be able to give money?
That's right, Larry. That's the principled position. And even if you want to be practical, take a practical, result-oriented point of view, that is, even if you're sitting and thinking, well, let's see, how can we try to get the most progressives elected, which I would argue is not the proper question to ask when you're in the position of deciding what the ground rules will be for elections. You should decide what's fair and proper, and that's the question that you've just asked. Since you can't vote for people outside of your district, why should you be able to give them money?
Well, it obviously favors
the wealthy and the people who have the more money. But even if you're taking a result-oriented point of view and asking, well, how can we help progressives, I mean, the few dollars, the trickle of dollars which is coming in from environmentalists outside of the district or from women outside of a district to support a women candidate is just overwhelmed by the special interest money. When I say that 90% of the money is coming out from outside of the district, surely Ruth does not contend that most of that money is coming from small progressive donors scattered around California. She knows it's coming from big fat cat interests, and we would be shutting down that huge flow of money, and the relative trickle of money that we would shut down on the progressive side would be pale by comparison.
Well, I think that both initiatives certainly, the point is not so much, okay, is the money coming from inside the district or outside? The point is, let's get rid of the ability for well-heeled special interests to give huge campaign contributions. In California right now, there are no limits. It's unlimited. If I have $1 million, I can give $1 million, and the only thing I'm required to do is disclose it. That is an obscene system, completely obscene. And what we need to do is radically change that. We do that. Candidates who agree to a spending limit are only allowed to receive $500. That's it. So certainly it does allow for, and then progressive groups and individuals can certainly make a difference under that system. Right now, it's very difficult to make a difference or even be heard because of the unlimited campaign contributions. Unfortunately, the other provision in our measure, no one group, no one entity would be allowed to give more than $25,000 in a two-year period, and that includes contributions to the party as well. Unfortunately, in the CalPERG measure, there is a provision which sounds good, and in theory is a nice idea, and that's a citizens committee that allows people to give you $25 in a one-year period, and they can form citizens committees. Those citizens committees would be allowed to contribute $10,000. That is 100 times the amount that individuals can give. And the problem with that is that every single special interest, Philip Morris right now has something like 50 front groups, every single special interest is going to look at that and go, gee, I need to reconfigure myself so that we can give $10,000. That disparity, unfortunately, provides for a huge loophole that a lot of groups are going to take advantage of. As I said, the idea is nice. The idea is sort of the right idea, and, you know, let's try and get individuals together. But when you have a disparity like that, campaign consultants are very clever. Special interests aren't going to sit down and go, oh, dear, oh, my, we're not going to be able to participate in the process. And so, therefore, they are going to reconfigure themselves. And that's why some of the state's largest PAC contributors support PERG measure.
You know, when I hear this kind of discussion going on about a ballot measure in the state of California, assuming they both qualify, one has, one hasn't so far, I immediately start visualizing in my mind the anti-campaign that is going to be run. And you are both going to be painted into the same corner. First of all, you're going to be pictured as quarreling with each other and not able to agree on reform. And second of all, you're going to be painted by your opposition as being anti-American, really, anti-freedom, anti-choice. Can you see that coming down the road as I can?
Well, I agree, Larry. And on the quarreling issue, let me just say that I think that's why it's so important that backers of both of these initiatives, and there are many people out there who will back both of them, and there are some who prefer one over the other, but I would argue should still vote for both. I would argue stop the quarreling and focus on the overall need to stop the political corruption in California of big money, to achieve political reform, and to work as much as possible by pushing a positive message, because you're absolutely right. There is no question that there's going to be an attack on both of these initiatives. Our only quarrel, and as Ruth knows, there are many features of the alternative initiative that I can support. There are some that I'm not enthused about, but that's neither here nor there. The important thing is that we just feel it doesn't go near far enough. I mean,
That's Doug Phelps of California's Against Political Corruption. Ruth Holton of California Common Cause will get a response from you in just a minute. We're talking about two California initiatives on campaign finance reform, then the fight against toxic chemicals in California. You're listening to Democracy Now!, all that after this. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. Today is Monday, and so we're looking at money. I'm Amy Goodman. Joining me in the studios of KPFA, our Pacifica station in Berkeley, is Larry Bensky. And joining us on the telephone are two Californians who are involved in electoral politics in one way or other. We're joined by Doug Phelps. He's head of Californians Against Political Corruption, and they're trying to get an initiative on the ballot for the fall that would drastically limit campaign contributions, limit them in all sorts of ways. We're also joined by Ruth Holton, Executive Director of California Common Cause. They have an initiative on the ballot. Ruth Holton, Doug Phelps was just explaining some of the reasons he disagreed with you. Your response?
Well, our response, unfortunately, the situation started, we wouldn't have to have this confusing conflict before the voters with two measures on the ballot. We had already turned in our signatures when they decided to go forward, and I think that that was really an unfortunate decision because it does confuse the voters. There is a lot in theirs and in ours, which is very similar. Second, I would like to make clear that those candidates who receive a contribution of $500 can only do so if they agree to a spending limit. The contribution limit that we provide is $100 at the local level. It's $250 for legislative races. And the Supreme Court has said that you need to have a real incentive, provide a real incentive, if you're going to have spending limits. And so our incentive is that you're allowed to receive double the contribution limit. This is a system that has been in place in the city of Oakland. It was worked very successfully. Every candidate agreed to the spending limits. And spending limits is truly what levels the playing field. And many people said they'd never seen so many public discussions and public debates by the candidates. I think going from an unlimited system where you have no money to contributions where you can receive $500 and you agree to a spending limit is a phenomenal improvement in this system. It really will force candidates to go to the grassroots. It will allow grassroots to get together, to join with their resources, and really have an impact on the system. And that's what we need to do. Also, we need to do it in a way that right now the courts would allow us to do so that we have reform now. Californians, can't afford to wait. The system is desperately broken. It needs to be fixed now. And we just don't want to gamble with the possibility that maybe sometime in the future that will happen.
This is going to be on the ballot in November, your measure anyway, perhaps the other one. We're going to have a presidential election in November. How do you see this interplaying, both of you, with the presidential election? Do you expect either Bill Clinton or Bob Dole or Ross Perot or Ralph Nader or any of those people to make campaign finance reform of your kind an issue in November?
The reason that we want this issue to be on the November ballot is that the presidential candidates, no matter whom they are going to be forced to take on the issue of campaign finance reform. And they're going to be asked to take a position on campaign finance reform.
Certainly, have you already asked them?
Ralph Nader has already taken a position on the issue of campaign finance reform. He hasn't come out for either one of the measures specifically. Ross Perot has already taken an issue a support on campaign finance reform. He personally hasn't come out in support of ours, but United We Stand America, which was his former organization, is very much a part of our, is one of the sponsors of our initiative and very much a part of it. Dole has not come out, but the point is that there will be campaign finance reform is an issue that will be on the November ballot, will force all candidates, not just the presidential candidates, but all candidates will be forced to discuss the issue.
Doug?
To answer your question directly, I doubt that any of them will take a position on these in-state initiatives. They don't, because we can't at the state level affect federal campaign finance. You know, they don't affect federal campaign finance. They don't affect the presidential campaign finance situation. So typically they will avoid these state initiatives. Why take a position on something that you don't have to? I agree with Ruth that I think we can use these as leverage to just the fact that there is a debate going on about campaign finance is positive. And the more states we can make that happen, the better. And the more that voters are thinking about this, they may well ask people running for president in California what their position is on this issue generally. And I think I'm certain from Nader we can expect strong support for campaign finance reform. I'm less sanguine about the positions of Perot, Dole, Clinton, and possibly some of the others who may be running, because they've all gotten where they are because they either have personally or have been able to raise huge amounts of money. I mean, after all, in election after election at the presidential level for my political lifetime, the candidates in both parties who've been able to raise the most money are the ones who've gotten the nomination.
One final technical question, which I think listeners are probably raising in their own minds. What happens if both of these measures are on the ballot and they both pass?
Well, if the PERGs and the PERGs provide specifically that if both pass and theirs get the most votes, then all the other measures on the November ballot are null and void in its entirety. They also provide that if theirs passes but gets fewer votes, then theirs should be implemented to the fullest extent provided by law. We have no such provision in ours. In California, the law requires that it is, in fact, the court to decide if there are conflicting provisions, what those conflicting provisions are. We've decided that it really is up to the court to decide, not up to proponents of initiatives to decide whether theirs should trump the other one.
Whichever one gets the most votes will take effect and prevail. That's kind of pretty clear. That works both directions.
Doug Phelps and Ruth Holton, my last two questions are, why isn't the legislature doing this, and what about television campaign ads?
Well, there's a good reason why the legislature's not doing it. I think we would both agree it's completely contrary to legislative interests. They've managed to get into office and stay in office because of the system that we have. As I said, right now in California, it's unlimited campaign contributions. And the legislature is, in fact, some members of the legislature are proposing a third measure, which is extraordinarily weak, in an effort to kill the measure that the voters pass. So it's going to be a very interesting fight. But members of the legislature cannot, will not cut off their own campaign contribution sources.
Doug Phelps, the issue of TV campaign, of TV advertising.
Well, I'm not sure what you're saying the issue is there. I think we would all prefer that to whatever extent candidates are able to raise money, that they spend it on more informative and illuminating discussions than your 30-second negative TV ads. To the extent that they find those effective in tearing down their opponents, I'm afraid we can expect that they're going to continue to use them. At the federal level, I believe certainly PERG and Common Cause both share the view that one of the things that we could do would be to require both in the area of postal service and in the electronic media more free time to be made available to candidates as one of the solutions to providing information to voters without it being dependent on which candidate is the most sold out to wealthy interests.
Well, we want to thank you both for joining us. What about your phone numbers for people who are interested in these initiatives around the country? Well, why don't we begin with Ruth Holton of California Common Cause?
The Californians for Political Reform can be contacted at area codes 916-443-1792 or in Los Angeles at area code 310-475-8285.
And Californians Against Political Corruption can be contacted at in California in Los Angeles at 310-397-5270 and in Washington, D.C. at 202-546-9707.
And that was Doug Phelps with Californians Against Political Corruption. Ruth Holton is head of California Common Cause. They are part of the group Californians for Political Reform. Californians for Political Reform have a ballot initiative in California that will be voted on in the fall on campaign finance reform. As to whether Doug Phelps' group, Californians Against Political Corruption, get their initiative on the ballot remains to be seen. And you're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, as you know, tomorrow is the California primary, also the primaries in Washington State and Nevada. We're going to continue our focus on California today. We turn to the battle against toxics. This growing movement around the country doesn't get much attention from the mainstream media, maybe because many of the polluting corporations environmentalists are targeting are also major advertisers in the newspapers and TV networks in this country. 2 weekends ago, there was a conference of more than 500 environmentalists in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, on dioxin, a byproduct of incineration or any industrial process that uses chlorine. Three of the activists that were there were Leslie Beister, program director for the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition in San Jose, California, Henry Clark, head of the West County Toxics Coalition in Richmond, California, and Bradley Angel, Southwest Toxic Campaign Coordinator for Greenpeace in San Francisco. They join us now. Leslie Beister, what are the toxics you're focusing on?
We're looking a lot at the chlorine-based chemicals, organochlorines, and the chemicals that have the capacity to mimic naturally occurring hormones in the body because of the fact that they cross generations, that they pass from mother to child either in utero or through breast milk, or the fact that a lot of these chemicals are cancer-causing. And because they contain chlorine, when they're combusted or treated in various ways, dioxin is released.
And in your work, where do you see these chlorine chemicals?
A lot of the chlorinated compounds are used a lot in the electronics industry as solvents. And so we're trying to look at phasing out the organochlorines and finding safe alternatives for the workers who are exposed to the chemicals.
You know, for people outside California, we hear Silicon Valley a lot, but I don't think a lot of people really know what it is. What is the magnitude of the industry there?
Silicon Valley is the birthplace of the electronics industry. In Silicon Valley, people have Well, not in Silicon Valley anymore, but there's this image that the electronics industry is a clean industry. You do not have the black billowing smokestacks coming out, but it's a very toxic industry. It's a chemical handling industry because of the amount of chemicals used to make a computer. Sometimes some computers take up to 500 chemicals to manufacture a computer. Mm. And the magnitude in trying to find out what are the chemicals that are being used and the toxicity of the chemicals is sometimes very difficult to ascertain.
How many people work in Silicon Valley?
I'm not sure, but I know the electronics industry hires a proportionate number of young, immigrant, childbearing age women, and a lot of the chemicals they're exposed to have a reproductive toxicity. Some of the chemicals have been connected to miscarriages, and so we're really trying to focus on a lot of the chemicals that the workers in the plant are exposed to because they're on the front line. They're the ones who are exposed to the chemicals first, and the chemicals that happen in the environment come from the plants. They're not naturally occurring. They come from the semiconductor plants.
Have you had any successes?
There was a campaign back in 1989 to phase out CFCs. It was found that IBM was the largest user of CFC chemicals, and through campaigns and building community support and action, IBM did phase out CFCs and are now using a soap and water alternative. So there are safe alternatives out there, and the industry has the capacity to change, and we just need to encourage them to do that.
CFCs,
chlorofluorocarbons.
And what do they do?
They're an ozone-depleting chemical, and that's another concern, that the ozone hole keeps growing, and we're trying to find alternatives to CFCs and a lot of the other chemicals that are used by the electronics industry.
Henry Clark, you are head of the West County Toxics Coalition in Richmond, which is in the Bay Area, a little north of San Jose. What about the toxics that you're targeting? What is your group doing?
The West County Toxics Coalition, based in Richmond, California, has been carrying on a campaign against the Chevron Corporation located in Richmond since 1986. Chevron is the major operation among 20 other industrial operations in the city of Richmond. Chevron operates the oil refinery in Richmond, and the Chevron Ortho Chemical Company, the pesticide division, where Chevron operates a hazardous waste incinerator that has been operating under an interim permit since 1967. This incinerator is spewing deadly methylene chloride and dioxins into our community, a predominantly Afro-American community with about 100 Southeast Asian families of a recent location in that community. There's high rates of cancer in the North Richmond community. There's a high incident of childhood asthma and a 33% higher than state average lung cancer rate.
So what are you doing about it?
Well, the West County Toxics Coalition, first of all, has been organizing residents in the surrounding area, going door-to-door in the affected communities, educating residents about the chemical exposure, getting them to become part of the organization, because we need an organization in order to fight back. That's the only way that we're going to bring about any change in being organized. So we work to hold Chevron and other companies accountable to reduce the risk from chemical hazards, and we work to prevent any other polluting companies from locating in this environment. We feel that we are already saturated with the chemical handling, polluting industry already. This is the situation where we call environmental racism or environmental injustices. We've conducted a study titled Richmond at Risk with one of our allied organizations, Community for a Better Environment, and that study indicated that of the 20 largest industrial operations located in the city of Richmond, they're located in communities of color where 70 to 75% of the population is Afro-American, and 20 to 25% of the population live below the poverty line. This is what is called environmental racism. In regard to the incinerator there, which is a deadly concern to us, we view that as living under a toxic a gas cloud, living in a toxic gas chamber. This incinerator is spewing deadly dioxins into our community, which causes breast cancer, hormonal disorders. And I find it very appalling that Chevron has been able to operate this incinerator on a temporary permit since 1967. The company gives lip service to waste reduction and toxic use reduction. Yet the company is proceeding to ask the state of California, the Department of Toxic Substance Control, to grant them a permit that would allow them to double the waste that they're burning. These type of contradictions cannot be accepted, especially in light of the recent research on the detrimental health effects from dioxins and the organochlorines. We need to work with the community and hold the state and Chevron accountable to reducing the waste that's being incinerated in our community, hold the Chevron accountable to exploring alternative means of disposing of the waste in the incinerator and eventually phase that incinerator out. That's the only just thing to do.
Is it difficult to organize in a community, especially when you're talking about a poor community, where people are mostly concerned with just getting by, with getting food on the table? How do you organize around environmental issues?
Well, it's very difficult to do because there are so many problems in our community. As you indicated, there's unemployment, there's toxic chemical exposure, there's crime. The daily struggle to just survive and live is difficult enough. As long as talking about a lead contamination or the incinerator and dioxins, which many people don't quite understand yet. But the reality of the situation is that all the problems are actually connected and related, and that's the message that West County Toxics Coalition carries to our residents. It basically stemmed from a situation of lack of power and over the decisions that affect our life. Here in a situation where you have a predominantly low-income community. City Hall does not listen to our interests because people do not have the money to contribute to the politician's campaign. We don't have the influence to affect any type of change down at City Hall. So what we do have is our numbers, though, and that's why the West County Toxics Coalition proceeds to organize residents so that we can hold the politicians accountable, we can hold the companies accountable, we can begin to build a grassroots movement to show some people power to effect some change in our lives.
Henry Clark is head of the West County Toxics Coalition in Richmond, California. Leslie Beister with Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition in San Jose. And we'll be joined by the coordinator of Greenpeace in San Francisco after this. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's national daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. We continue our discussion about the fight against toxics in California. Our guests, Leslie Beister, Program Director of Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition in San Jose, Henry Clark, head of the West County Toxics Coalition in Richmond, California, and we now go to Bradley Angel, Southwest Toxic Campaign Coordinator for Greenpeace in San Francisco. Bradley, who are you targeting?
Well, right now, the Greenpeace campaign in the Southwest U.S. is working in dozens of communities. And again, predominantly, not exclusively, but predominantly communities of color, low-income communities of color, because that's where we see the disproportionate impact of dirty industry. That's where we see the most dangerous chemicals being incinerated, being dumped, or companies trying to open up dangerous new facilities in communities that they feel are politically powerless. One of the places we are working right now is in Richmond with the West County Toxics Coalition fighting the proposed expansion, doubling of the amount of waste that Chevron Chemical Company wants to spew into our environment that they want to burn. We're also working, for example, in the African-American, predominantly African-American neighborhood in San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point. Like Richmond, in San Francisco, virtually all the dirty industry is dumped in the black community. And I've worked there for many years, for about 8 or 9 years now, and I knew from that work that there was a lot of health problems, that there were respiratory problems, a lot of cancer. A lot of it was anecdotal, though. And this past summer, the county health department finally came out with a study that documented what we had feared all along, that African-American women under 50 in the toxic-contaminated area of San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood had twice, at least twice, the rate of breast cancer as women not living in that part of the city. And what's astounding about that, of course, I mean, it's alarming just to see that discrepancy anyway, and we don't want to see anybody with breast cancer, black or white or anybody else. But what's really startling and should be a wake-up call for people across this country, not just in San Francisco, is the fact that San Francisco was already reported to have one of the highest rates of breast cancer in the world prior to the coming out of this study. So if you add a study that documents that African-American women have twice that already alarming rate, you have a public health emergency. In that community, they're fighting off a power plant that would be the third power plant in that impacted community, on top of the hundreds of other toxic sites. And what we've been doing is
a nuclear power plant?
No, this would be a quote-unquote natural gas power plant, which the companies say, oh, it's much cleaner than coal, and which in one sense may be true, but the fact is that they're not shutting down the old plants, and the fact is that these allegedly clean plants are not clean, they would still spew out enormous amounts of particulates as well as cancer-causing chemicals into the environment. And an environment of a community that is being devastated, literally, by breast cancer. So we've been, and Greenpeace has been supporting these community struggles, like in Bayview, Hunters Point, like in Richmond, working with folks in the Silicon Valley, but all across California and elsewhere. And one of the things that we've been doing is linking those communities up, bringing the people of Bayview Hunters Point together with the people of Richmond. One of the very exciting things that we've been doing that I think is so important is linking those communities up with breast cancer advocacy organizations, breast cancer survivors, starting to do more work linking up with workers in the in these toxic industries, and building new alliances.
I want to get to your challenge to Breast Cancer Awareness Month in just a second, but Leslie Beister of the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition, you too are involved with attacking this high rate of cancer in the Bay Area. How are you organizing?
Well, we've set up, through community outreach, set up a campaign that we're calling the One Too Many campaign that we've brought together a broad range of people in the Silicon Valley, community residents, a couple of workers, people who work in the healthcare profession, breast cancer survivors, looking at no matter how many cancers you have, if it's 1 in 10, 1 in 100, 1 in 8, no matter what the denominator is, one cancer is one too many, especially when you realize that back in 1964, the World Health Organization said that 80% of the cancers are related to environmentally induced, caused events. And if 80% of these cancers are environmentally reduced, that means that we have a chance and the opportunity to reduce that, that it's caused by these man-made or person-made chemicals that are going out into the environment, and we have to stop this. It's like I think of it as the old Union of Concerned Scientists that had the 5 minutes to midnight clock, and the clock keeps getting closer and closer to midnight, and if we don't pull that minute hand back, we're speaking of our own destruction, of our own deaths. And it's time for action now, and that's what the One Too Many campaign is about. That's what this conference is about. And it's also taking on a much broader national movement that I was fortunate to be at a founding conference in May in Albuquerque of the National Coalition for Health and Environmental Justice, which is bringing together groups of women and people who had worked together in their own communities before, but this is coalescing into a national movement. We've got women from the National Coalition, the National Black Women's Health Coalition, Greenpeace, the Indigenous Environmental Network, the Toxics Coalition. There's 21 member groups of the National Coalition for Health and Environmental Justice, and it's looking that we have to be talking about our health. We're talking about our health, our environment, and our children, our families. We have to be protecting our health because we can't rely on the corporations and the government to do it for us. We have to take the action now to make that happen.
Speaking of the corporations, Bradley Angel, Breast Cancer Awareness Month, what do you do about it?
Well, as some people may know, but actually most people don't know, every October is a highly publicized month called Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And people know that some people wear ribbons to commemorate those who died, and sometimes there's vigils. But what people don't know in general is that those events are sponsored by the very same corporations, some of the same corporations, like Zeneca Corporation, that produces cancer-causing chemicals.
Like what corporation?
Zeneca Corporation is one of those. But we see events like walks for women in cancer that are last year in San Francisco that was sponsored by Chevron, you know, the same company that manufactures and emits cancer-causing chemicals into the environment. And the Toxic Links Coalition, of which Greenpeace is a part, and Silicon Valley and West County are also a part of, and many others, has taken as a major task to expose the fact that you have these cancer-causing industries promoting, quote-unquote, Breast Cancer Awareness Month. We've renamed it, and we call it Cancer Industry Awareness Month. So we do a lot of education around it to let people know about the toxic links involved. But we've also done something... the next step, which is action. So for 2 years in a row now, there's been marches in downtown San Francisco called Cancer Industry Awareness, Cancer Industry Tours of downtown San Francisco to show that it's, we want more than breast cancer awareness. This is really cancer industry. The corporations that are dumping cancer-causing chemicals into our bodies, in our air, in our water, in our food, the government complicity and the cancer establishment that's doing nothing about it. And we're taking them on, and we're challenging them and exposing them and saying, you are no longer going to get away with the poisoning of our communities.
So where do you go?
Well, for example, the last 2 years in a row, the event started at Chevron in downtown San Francisco, where people from the community, as well as breast cancer survivors and others, talked about what Chevron does, what they make, what they emit into the environment of the Bay Area and elsewhere. We went to Bechtel Corporation, which is very tied into nuclear power. We went to the offices of San Francisco Energy Corporation, which is the company that hopes to build the new power plant in Bayview, Hunters Point, where people from that community with breast cancer talked about the new studies, that talked about that one more cancer in that community is one too many, as Leslie says. We went to the offices of American Cancer Society, which by and large has been promoting the industry line of, well, we need more research and more industry-promoted cures, and breast cancer survivors there challenged American Cancer Society to work and take action for prevention and not to continue apologizing for the cancer industry. So those are the types of things we've done. We challenged the U.S. EPA to take the side and of the people in the environment and actually start doing its job, you know, Environmental Protection Agency, not Polluter Protection Agency. So these are the types of things we've done as a kind of a roving march through downtown San Francisco. We also stopped at Time Magazine because Time Magazine has not fulfilled its promise to stop using chlorine in the bleaching process for the paper that they use in their magazine. Several years ago, Time said, once chlorine-free processes are available in the United States of high quality, they would start printing their Time Magazine on chlorine-free paper. Well, guess what? It's available, but they haven't followed through their promise. So this past October, breast cancer survivors during the toxic tour delivered thousands of postcards to Time demanding they keep their promise.
And, of course, chlorine used in the paper making process produces the byproduct of dioxin, and this is what you're concerned with.
That's right. And you know, a couple of years ago, the U.S. EPA, under pressure from the chlorine and chemical industry, embarked on a study that they hoped to show that groups like Greenpeace and West County Toxics Coalition and Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition, that we were exaggerating the threat from dioxin. That and they actually thought that this study by 100 or so scientists would prove that it was much less of a threat. Well, guess what? The U.S. EPA, in their draft reassessment, came out and said, oops, it's much worse than we ever thought. And yes, it causes cancer. Dioxin causes cancer. But that's the least of your worries. And what they're starting to find out is what our worst fears are, is that dioxin causes not only cancer, but birth defects, reproductive, developmental, immunological disorders that are so fundamental to the future of the human race. And this study backfired on the industry. This study backfired in the EPA that was seeking to cover up, we believe, the very serious danger of this. And that's why, coming back to our communities, we see this work going on in Silicon Valley that Leslie's involved in, the work in Richmond that Henry and his group are involved in. And we're making those links back in the communities, impacts on communities and workers.
Well, the other thing that the EPA said is that we're carrying a body burden of dioxin in us already, and that many of the problems that we're seeing might be related to that. If you think of your body as a little beaker and you keep adding drops at a time, it's going to spill over. And that spillover is where we're seeing the reproductive problems, and that spillover level is different for every different individual. And that's what we're looking at, is that the reproductive and the other problems are happening at much, much lower levels than the cancer level. And that's why we're really looking at dioxin. I'm very concerned about the body burden and that we've got to stop it. We've got to stop the way that our bodies are ingesting it. And it's very hard because 90% of our dioxin intake comes from food. It means it's airborne, so you've got to stop it. You've got to stop dioxin at its source. You've got to stop dioxin from being produced. And that's ultimate pollution prevention.
Henry Clark with the West County Toxics Coalition in Richmond. What about electoral politics? How do you interface with that? Do you have any hope for elected politicians? Are they bought off by the very corporations you're protesting?
Yes, well, by and large, we think that the politicians are in the hands of the corporations. We have seen that in Richmond. Richmond has been known to be a company town controlled by Chevron. Chevron Corporation contributes over 25% of the city of Richmond's tax base. Chevron is the largest employer in the city of Richmond. Chevron is the largest employer in Contra Costa County. However, there are some opportunities. For instance, the present mayor of Richmond, Mayor Rosemary Corbin, is a environmental person, considered the environmental mayor of Richmond. I've worked with the mayor as a member of the Contra Costa County Hazardous Materials Commission. So there is opportunity. What we have found out from our interaction with regulatory agencies and politicians, we found that the corporation had the major influence, which have inspired many of our members to run for elected office. We've had members to run for the mayor of Richmond, to run for the Richmond City Council. And it have also inspired myself to get more actively involved in the political process. In fact, in the community of North Richmond, which is on the front line of the toxic assault in the area that's surrounded and saturated by the petrochemical industry, North Richmond is predominantly an unincorporated area, means that most of the community of 2,400 people come under the jurisdiction of the Contra Costa County Board of Supervisors. A smaller part of North Richmond is governed by the City of Richmond. Well, West County Toxics Coalition, working with the community, took advantage of some opportunities in the law to set up a North Richmond Municipal Advisory Council. What this means is that the community elects their own representatives from the community that governs the community in conjunction with the Contra Costa County Board of Supervisors. We were appointed the first year of office by the Board of Supervisors. However, for the last 2.5 years, we have become the first elected officials from the North Richmond community. So technically, I'm an elected official from the community, which is very inspiring to me in that I was born and raised in North Richmond. And in fact, the development in the Bay Area is happening in the North Richmond community. North Richmond is the last frontier of large acres of industrial land. And if we did not have this council in place, we feared that the polluting industry would have just swamped in our area and overwhelmed us. But now, since we have the North Richmond Municipal Advisory Council in place, any company that wants to locate in our community has to come before the North Richmond Municipal Advisory Council, and we have to give the approval for that company to locate there. Otherwise, there's a strong chance that it may not end up being sited in our community. So this is community empowerment, and this is this have come about as a result of seeing the need for more grassroots community people to get involved in the political process and to have some leverage in our interest to counteract that corporate stranglehold down at City Hall.
And that is Henry Clark, head of the West County Toxics Coalition in Richmond, California. He's been joined by Bradley Angel, Southwest Toxic Campaign Coordinator for Greenpeace in San Francisco, and Leslie Beister, Program Director for the Toxics Coalition in San Jose, California. We want to thank you all for joining us and let our listeners know that they all attended the third annual conference on dioxin. It was called Time for Action. And if you want information on any of these groups in California or around the country, you can call the Clearinghouse, the Citizens Clearinghouse for Hazardous Waste, at 703-237-2249. That's 703-237-2249. And if you'd like a tape of today's program, you can call our Pacifica archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. It was engineered by Bernard White. Our director in New York, Errol Maitland. I'm Amy Goodman for Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And remember, keep listening, tell your friends about Democracy Now! To urge other radio stations around the country to run it, and let us know you're listening by writing to us on email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Thanks for listening.